good evening. It's Saturday evening, time for the Saturday evening libertarian conversation. And here we are on Saturday, December 10th, 2005. And we have, I think, a very, very interesting program lined up for you because we have a very interesting guest who will be coming on in the second segment, Mr. Brad Smith, a former Federal Communications Commission, former Federal Elections Commission commissioner, and he's got a very interesting story to tell, and I think you're going to find it very interesting and very relevant to what I've been saying over the years about the third parties being shut out of the political process. Before we begin, however, just a look at the news in this first segment. We finished the last show last week. In the last segment, I said that there really was no such thing as a war on terror. It in actuality, is a war on straw men. It's being the war on terror is being used as a setup to put a lot of people in jail, both here and overseas. It's an opportunity to get even with people around the world. It's a chance to have the Bush administration do a lot of things that it couldn't do if it just simply was following the law and arresting criminals instead of playing world policemen and running around the world. And if you doubt that, just recently the Bush administration released, or pardon me, let me put it this way, it was brought to bear that brought to light that there are 80,000 people on a no-fly list. A Swedish airline brought this to light, that there are 80,000 people who are banned from flying to over America, or at least they are going to be hunted down and taken off of planes and searched and given special treatment. 80,000 people. Now, do you think that the terror war, that the enemy comprises 80,000 people? I really don't. But here is an example of how the Bush administration is using the war on terror. And I don't know how many people are going to be on that list by the time it's done. You and me and a lot of other people may wind up finding ourselves on that list. And if we do, we're going to be singled out as terrorists and or suspected terrorists. And being a suspected terrorist is all you have to be taken into custody. Recently, a German man was held in custody for a long period of time, 5 months. 5 months, not terribly long, you say? Well, it is if you're being tortured. And during that period, no rights were accorded to him. He did not have the right to an attorney. He did not have the opportunity to find out exactly what he was being accused of. He had no right to find out what it was that he had done. And as a result, he just simply was a stateless person. They found out at the end of it that he really wasn't guilty of anything, and they let him go. Let him go, and there he was, returned eventually to Germany, but they couldn't return his arms and legs to him in the fashion that they had been before. This is the war on terror, and it really is not a war. As I said last week, when Timothy McVeigh blew up the Oklahoma City building, he committed a criminal act, and he committed a crime that should have been prosecuted, but instead it was treated as an act in the war on terror. So we need to understand that people do commit crimes in this world, and we need to understand that people who do that are not terrorists in the sense that they can be prosecuted as terrorists. And we need to understand that these people should not be dragged off and held responsible as terrorists. They should be held as criminals, and when they are those criminals and accorded all the rights of suspected criminals. Well, I'd like to take this opportunity now to lead into what we will be talking about for the next hour. We have a very interesting show. For a long time, I have said that we do not have a two-party system. We do not have a multi-party system in America. What we have is a two-party system, and that two-party system is made up of Democrats and Republicans. And because it is made up of Democrats and Republicans, it is closed to any third party. It also is closed to non-incumbents who are not part of the staged political process. But that's another story that we'll get into as we proceed during the end, proceedings this evening. What we have are people who are closed to the political process because they are not Democrats or Republicans. That means Libertarians, Greens, Constitutional Party are shut out of the process. And we need to get more parties in the process, just as they have in Canada and in England and in other places. Only then will we be able to see other people in the political process in America. And I want to see Greens, Libertarians, Constitutionalists, and other people in the political process. And if we do that, we will have an opportunity to get more ideas into the political process in America. I pointed out that people in America do not have the opportunity to talk about less government. They do not have the opportunity to see less government. They do not have the opportunity to look at some of the opportunities that exist in America for new ideas, and as a result, we are not getting the ideas displayed that ought to be displayed. As you know, I ran for president twice, and because I was a third-party candidate, I got the obligatory third-party interview that gave me the chance to be heard once, but that was it. Any time I came back, I never heard, never got a second interview. And as a result of that, I just simply did not have the chance to present ideas that people might want to hear. People might want to know the prospects for various possibilities that existed. Well, when we come back, Jim Baska is going to introduce Brad Smith, and he's going to have the opportunity to introduce Brad Smith to you in a way that will give you the chance to see what it was that was going on at the Federal Election Commission. I'll be right back.
If you produce computer storage media, you need GlideRite test heads. GlideRite is a major supplier of test heads to most media manufacturers in the U.S. and Asia. In addition, GlideRite produces glide heads, burnish heads, certifier heads, and thermal asperity heads, focusing on meeting your specific needs with short turnaround times and optimum quality, all at a competitive price. GlideRite's delivery performance is unmatched, whether quantities are large or small. GlideRite has manufacturing facilities in Milpitas, California, and Ho Chi Minh, Vietnam. Each site is equipped with state-of-the-art tooling and computerized equipment. GlideRite's services include research and development, new design and technology, and engineering support. Whether you need standard heads or customized solutions, GlideRite is your expert source. So when designing hard disks, always specify GlideRite.
The Harry Brown Show is brought to you by the Genesis Communications Radio Network.
back. This is Harry Brown on the Saturday Evening Libertarian Conversation. And right after the 2000 election, Jim Babka headed up a drive to challenge the Federal Elections Commission and to take the case all the way to the Supreme Court, and he did not succeed in winning the suit that they brought against the Federal Elections Commission, even though they had a number of people on their side. But one of his allies was Brad Smith, one of the Federal Election Commissioners, and we have Brad Smith as a guest tonight, and because Jim has been so involved in this, I want to turn this over to him, and from now on, you're going to be talking with, listening to Jim Babka and Brad Smith. Good evening, Jim.
Good evening, Harry. I'm privileged to be here. And I want to take this opportunity to give out the phone number, 1-800-259-9231, if you're going to have a question tonight. We're going to be talking about campaign finance reform, 1-800-259-9231. Or if you want to email me, you can reach me at the email address we use for my day job, comments@downsizedc.org, if you have questions for Brad Smith. Well, my guest, as Harry mentioned, is Brad Smith, and he served on the Federal Elections Commission from May 2000 to, I believe, May 2005. We'll get that confirmed in just a moment. And he is the author of the book, Unfree Speech, The Folly of Campaign Finance Reform, and presently is at has returned to Capital University, where he is a professor. And I'm just really tickled to be able to have him on the Harry Brown Show tonight. Brad, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, Jim. It's my pleasure.
Let's start off with your nomination. I want to first of all confirm you did just resign from the Federal Election Commission. You were one of six commissioners in what month?
Right, I resigned in August. My term actually ended in May, so you were right on that. But under the statute for the FEC, you can keep serving until your replacement is named. In fact, now right now, two of the commissioners have been serving in that capacity for over 2 years. But I had very little interest in doing that. I served my term. It was an honor to do it. A good experience. Back to the private sector.
And you were eager to get back to the private sector. Why?
Well, I think I, you know, from a personal standpoint, I learned really what I could learn. I think from a policy standpoint, I had accomplished most of what I could accomplish. I'm sure that I could do more continuing to be there. But, you know, we all have our own lives to live as well. And I'm not falling out of the fray. I'll continue to write and speak on campaign finance reform. In fact, I've been working with my former counsel there, Steve Kirsting, to organize a new group that will be a consistent pro-freedom group devoted specifically to this issue.
Now, that's interesting. Steve, I'm assuming you say counsel, he was working at the FEC?
He was on my personal staff, so he was not
okay.
A career employee.
Okay, very good, very good. So there was more than, there were two of you there that understood what the First Amendment was all about. We're going to talk about the First Amendment probably in the next segment, but I want to start off with a little bit about you. And first of all, let's share with everybody the story of you being nominated, because this absolutely fascinates me. It's a very strange process to begin with. As I understand it, there always is a bipartisan commission. It's not a nonpartisan commission like most of the rest of the government. It is a bipartisan commission with three Republican appointments and three Democrat appointments. And you were appointed by Bill Clinton in one of the Republican slots. So then-candidate Al Gore was critical of you, and so were others. Please share that story with our audience.
Sure. I mean, you've outlined the basic facts of it. I was a law professor and writing and teaching in the area of election law, and some of my writings got picked up. I mean, they were hitting good academic journals, but some got picked up by the folks at the Cato Institute, and they asked me to kind of write them up in a more easily accessible format, and we did, and they circulated them through Washington, and pretty soon I was being invited to testify with some regularity in Congress. So eventually when a Republican seat came up and President Clinton was in office, he turned, as presidents do in that situation, to the Senate leaders of the opposite party. And in this case, Trent Lott really went to Mitch McConnell, who was the Republican's point man on the issue, and said, who should we get? Senator McConnell and I had gotten to know each other through testifying before his committee, but otherwise it was kind of a bolt out of the blue. I hadn't been involved in Republican Party politics. I hadn't been a lawyer for any of the candidates or anything. But Senator McConnell has been very good on this issue, very strong for a long time, very pro-free speech, and he wanted somebody on the commission who would be tough. So he chose me, and the White House balked, and they went back and forth. And then, to my surprise, I'm sitting out in Ohio as a law professor in the middle of a presidential primary debate. Bill Bradley turns this into an issue with Al Gore and challenges Al Gore to denounce the nomination. And so Gore did, and it went on, and eventually I got savaged a bit by Al Hunt and the Washington Post and the New York Times and the usual enemies of freedom. And in the end, though, I think mainly due to the very strong support of Senator McConnell, I was placed on a commission, and hopefully we did some good there.
Well, do you happen to remember some of the things that were said about you?
Well, I was compared in various formats, various forms to David Duke, to the Unabomber, to a member of the Flat Earth Society. I was accused of being corrupt and ignorant, and all of this really came about simply because I didn't buy into the common norm that, well, of course we have to limit people's ability to participate in political campaigns. And, I mean, you know how it is. It's pretty basic. It's something you learn from the earliest childhood. When people don't have much merit to their position, they resort to name-calling.
Al Gore said about you, according to your book here, quote, "The last thing we need is an FEC commissioner who publicly questions not only the constitutionality of proposed campaign finance reforms, but also the constitutionality of current limitations," end quote.
That's right. I'd forgotten that. You're more up to date than I am. That's right. And I always responded by thinking, what a curious position to think that a person being appointed to federal office should not consider the constitutionality of the law. It struck me that that was exactly backwards. It's the first thing a person in federal office ought to be considering.
Well, I think maybe he's let us in a little bit on the mindset of a great many of the people that are in Washington, that if you don't support the program, Paul Krugman a few weeks ago on my radio show, I was talking about he was very upset about the prescription drug bill, and the prescription drug bill is bad, but he was discussing it, and he was upset because he said these people don't really believe in this, that promoted it, don't really believe in government programs, they shouldn't be designing government programs, and there's this mentality that if you don't agree and if you don't think that what you're going into is wonderful and that you ought to be zealous in pursuing the mission of that organization, you're not qualified. All citizens who disagree with the institution need not apply.
That's an excellent point, Jim. You know, one thing that they try very hard to do is to make it illegitimate for anybody who's a libertarian, you know, small L libertarian, to be in public office by saying essentially, you know, your job, if you're a federal election commissioner, is to regulate, and you must be in favor of all regulations. If you support deregulation, you're somehow not qualified or not capable for the position. And so they try to use these slots as sort of a one-way ratchet. As I always pointed out, however, you know, law enforcement is not intended to be turned over to zealots, and it's intended to come about with some kind of balance, at least. There's a lot of things in law I didn't like, but, you know, that doesn't mean you're not capable of enforcing it and bringing a little bit of more freedom to it.
Quick, simple yes or no question. When you took this position, were you required to swear an oath to the Constitution?
Yes.
Very good. 1-800-259-9231 if you want to talk to Brad Smith about campaign finance restrictions. We'll be right back.
In the 1960s, the politicians promised us the war on poverty would end hardship and suffering.
Instead, countless Americans now live trapped in despair. Billions of our tax dollars have been spent. And after 40 long years, the war remains to be won.
In the 1970s, the politicians promised us the war on drugs would reduce drug abuse and crime.
Instead, we've witnessed an increase in drug abuse, rising crime rates, and growing prison populations.
Most recently, the politicians promised us the war on illiteracy would improve our educational system.
Instead, our children's reading scores are plummeting. Many high school graduates struggle with the most basic English. And many politicians refuse to send their sons and daughters to the same schools they expect our children to attend.
Politicians rarely deliver what they promise. Usually, they deliver the opposite. Learn how you can make a difference. Visit DownsizeDC.com. That's DownsizeDC.com.
It's up to us.
The Harry Brown Show is brought to you by the Genesis Communications Radio Network.
It really is hard to resist the urge to waltz when you hear that music. 1-800-259-9231. Even though this is not Harry Brown, this is Harry Brown's show. I am your guest host tonight, Jim Babka, and we have Brad Smith joining us. He is a former commissioner of the FEC, which means, you know, he was basically a bureaucrat, but not one of the bad guys. Not one of the bad guys. In fact, we're going to demonstrate that tonight. We're going to talk about what it was like to be on the FEC. Brad, what did you find to be the most surprising or interesting thing about having served on the FEC? What happened to you that you absolutely did not expect?
You know, it's kind of funny. I don't know how much there is that I didn't expect, but there were things that I just thought, you know, really strike home. And the things that most of the listeners of this show will probably know, and a lot of Americans, I think, instinctively know. For example, just how very difficult it is to change anything. For a long time, the FEC, all of its publications, basically echoed the language of Common Cause and other groups that favor campaign finance regulation. And when I got on the commission, I said, look, you know, we're not taking sides in these debates. Our job is to apply the law in a fair, even-handed fashion, taking due consideration of, you know, the Constitution and so on, court decisions, interpreting it. Let's make our language more neutral. This was an enormous battle for me. It took me most of my first year on the commission to try to get that done, just to get the commission to quit using terms like sham advocacy to talk about people who would run ads about candidates' positions on issues and things like that. So what you really realize is how big a job you have in turning government around. The government is really on automatic pilot. You could get rid of all the political appointees and it would just rumble on and nobody would know. And the political appointees, to the extent they're there, are like the, almost like the Dutch boy putting his finger into the dike. And I'm saying the political appointees who are the good guys, the freedom lovers and so on. You're just hopelessly outnumbered. And it takes tremendous energy and effort just to get the most minor things done.
Let's talk a little bit about language, because language is really important to this discussion. This is a discussion that most people are not used to participating in, and the particular, there is a lingo to this, a technical lingo, that I have to tell you, you know, coming into this, you know, I started really investigating this issue seriously in 2000 during Harry Brown's presidential campaign. And as we were beginning to do our research, I got introduced to a whole bunch of terminology that was bizarre, to put it mildly. You know, things like hard money and soft money and sham issue ads and issue advocacy and so on and so forth. So I want to make sure that as we're going through this discussion tonight, our audience actually understands what we're talking about. What is hard money?
Hard money is regulated money. That is, it is money that is regulated by the Federal Election Campaign Act.
And then soft money is?
Unregulated money. It's money
okay,
that's
now,
not regulated.
In light of McCain-Feingold now, where they were attempting to get soft money under control, is that still, does that designation still exist?
Well, one of the tough things about this is that words have a variety of meanings. Soft money meant many different things to different people. But I say, really, what soft money is simply unregulated money. Back when Congress first began to regulate this stuff seriously in the 1970s, the Supreme Court issued an opinion called Buckley v. Vallejo. And the court's opinion, I'll say, was basically pretty protective of free speech. It had some major errors in it, major Achilles heels, things that opened up. But for the most part, it allowed you to say what you wanted to say. What the court said was, well, this infringes on people's First Amendment rights, but the government's interest in preventing corruption of office holders is so important. Well, let that happen where it's most likely to occur, and that's when office holders are actually soliciting campaign contributions. So, you know, they allowed limits to be placed on contributions to campaigns. But the court also said, but that's only contributions to campaign or only when people expressly advocate a candidate's election or defeat by saying things like vote for, vote against, support, defeat. Well, what happened eventually over the years was that people figured out, hey, that's a pretty narrow standard. You can run ads that say, you know, Congressman Jones wants to, poison your well water. He's been seen stealing Social Security checks out of mailboxes and molesting small children in the neighborhood. You know, call Congressman Jones and tell him to stop destroying America. And that was okay. That was allowed because you weren't specifically advocating his election or defeat. Now, you know, for people like you and like me, Jim, I mean, we don't see any problem why anybody should be prohibited from saying whatever they want about politics. But if you buy into the notion that there ought to be some limits on campaign contributions, The fact that you could run ads, like my little fictional ad I just gave, drove the regulatory community nuts. You know, they said, well, oh my gosh, this is just like a campaign ad and we can't regulate it. So McCain-Feingold attempted to regulate it in two ways. One was by saying political parties cannot take any unregulated money. They can't use any money for anything that's not, all their money has to be regulated under federal limits, and that means no union contributions, no corporate contributions, very limited personal contributions, disclosure of those contributions, a lot of reporting obligations, and so on. But then they went further and said, also, we're going to say that anybody who wants to run an ad that even mentions a candidate within 60 days of an election cannot do so if they take any corporate or union money, or if they are incorporated themselves. So, for example, if you incorporate a group and take only voluntary individual contributions, you still can't even run a broadcast ad that mentions a candidate within 60 days of an election. And that was unfortunately upheld by the Supreme Court, as you well know, in the
trial
of the FEC.
I was absolutely shocked when it happened, and I think even all the way into the White House they were shocked. First of all, the president should have never signed this bill into law, but when he did, he issued a statement saying that there were problems, and he mentioned this problem and said that he believed the Supreme Court was going to handle it, and they didn't.
Well, you know, he had poor advice and poor politics. You know, people, I think, do better in politics when they stick to their principles, and in this case, the calculation made by the big honchos in the Republican Party was that the Supreme Court would strike down most of the McCain-Feingold law, but they would therefore uphold that part of the law that increased the amount that individuals could actually give. And so they signed it into law, and they thought this would be beneficial politically to President Bush because he would benefit from the higher contributions. It was a very unfortunate decision. There were many people like myself who were saying, no, it's very likely the Supreme Court will uphold this law. I mean, it's ridiculous to those of us who, you know, how we think the Constitution ought to be. But look at what the Supreme Court's been doing. They are going to uphold this law.
You know,
and they did.
One of the things I found stunning in the case, and I don't know if I have enough time as we're winding into to the end of this segment, but the standard seemed to be different for both sides, at least from where I was sitting. And I realized I was a biased observer. I was running RealCampaignReform.org. We were one of the 80 or so plaintiffs in that action. But when Mitch McConnell, who was the lead plaintiff, said that he had worked as chair of the Republican conference in the Senate where he had assisted other candidates in running various types of ads, he had run ads himself in the past and he intended to do so in the future, the Supreme Court said, well, he isn't doing it now. But when the other side said, well, there's the hydraulic principle, which is the idea that money, like water, will always flow to the open cracks that we leave in this law, the Supreme Court goes, oh, yeah, that's reasonable. There just seemed to be a different standard.
Well, the worst thing about the opinion was the Supreme Court just seemed totally predisposed to buy anything the reformers said. The opinion reads like a bunch of common cause press releases strung together. Maybe we can talk about that a bit more as we get past the break.
1-800-259-9231, or you can email me at comments@downsizedc.org.
Currency devaluation, inflation, one and the same. If you had deposited $100,000 in a bank at 1% in a 30-month period dating from May 24, 2005, here is what happened to your funds. The dollar lost 33% of its value in that time frame. The bank paid you 1%. Your $100,000 now has a net purchasing power of $68,000. Here is reality. The devaluation of currency equals real inflation. Keep in mind how the value of your paper assets are measured in dollars. Gold in the same time frame increased 35% in value. Learn how to protect and profit in this truly unstable world economy. Call Midas Resources at 1-800-686-2237. That's 1-800-686-2237.
You're listening to The Harry Brown Show on the Genesis Communications Radio Network.
Thank you.
we're back. This is the Harry Brown Show, and I am Jim Babka, sitting in for Harry Brown tonight. Harry Brown opened the show and shared with you some commentary, kind of wrapping up some of the things we talked about last week about the war on terror and basically the non-existence of it. The fact that right now there's a propping up of various factions that, frankly, were considered radical previous to our attack in Iraq, but we've been forced to get in bed with some strange bedfellows. 1-800-259-9231 is our phone number here tonight, or you can email us at comments@downsizedc.org. My guest is Brad Smith. He is the author of the book On Free Speech and a former Federal Elections Commission commissioner. He served there from May 2000 to August 2005, and he is presently back at Capital University, where he is a professor. And he's shared with us a little bit about how he got into it and into the field of campaign finance reform and ended up becoming a FEC commissioner. And before we went to the break, we were busy defining terms, and a lot of things went past you in a flurry. We talked about Buckley versus Vallejo and McCain-Feingold. So let me pick up back there. If we could just give our audience a quick summary, Brad, what happened in Buckley versus Vallejo? When was it? What happened?
Right. Buckley v. Vallejo is a 1976 opinion of the Supreme Court. It concerns post-Watergate campaign finance reform efforts, and Congress placed very strict limits on what people can say and spend and do. In fact, stricter than we have in place now. But in Buckley, the court struck down many of those limits. They struck down limits on expenditures. It struck down limits on people's ability to contribute to their own campaigns, for example. However, to point out, they did allow contribution limits to be maintained. And then over the ensuing years, what happened was, because contribution limits were low, people began to spend money outside the system simply by not expressly advocating somebody's election or defeat. So we gradually move forward about 15 years. The regulators are really getting upset. Beginning in the early 1990s, they put about $200 million into a nationwide campaign over many years to basically convince folks that political participation is corrupt.
And by the way, I want to jump in and point out here, Brad, the people that you're talking about that did this, one of them is very notable, is the Pew Charitable Trust.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some news about the Pew Charitable Trust. There's something that really jumps out at me in this whole thing, and that was that the Pew Charitable Trust, in trying to change our law, wasn't regulated in any way. This is a tax-exempt corporation that was trying to influence the direction of legislation. They were calling for more legislation of the American people and their participation in the system, but their participation was unregulated.
Well, that's exactly right. Another big group was the Carnegie Corporation. They were in for about $20 million over the course of this period. Pew was the biggest. The George Soros' foundations were in for some big money, a lot of other groups. And as you point out, all of these groups remain untouched by the very kinds of regulations they want to put on everybody else. And, of course, that's the not-so-dirty little secret about campaign finance reform. It's really an effort to silence people who disagree with you politically. That's a major part of what it's all about. Not always intentionally, but always in the sense that nobody thinks their own speech is corrupt. Nobody thinks their own modes of wielding political influence are unfair. And so, naturally, they focus on limiting other people's ways of participating in politics. So, you know, a big PR push eventually gets us the McCain-Feingold bill. This puts more restrictions on participating. The key one a lot of folks are aware of is the fact that within 60 days of an election, you're very limited in your ability to even mention a candidate in an ad campaign, in a broadcast ad. And to the surprise of many, that was upheld by the Supreme Court. And what has happened now in the 2 years since is what we're really seeing is what I would call sort of the all-out war of all against all, with everybody jockeying for position now to use the regulations to try to silence their political opponents.
And that really is the case. And they pretend as if these 527 groups just came out of nowhere, like they didn't exist before. But that's not true, is it?
Right. Well, this is another thing that maybe some listeners are going, 527 groups, you know, what's that?
Right.
A 527 group is called that because 527 is the section of the tax code under which they organize. And all a 527 group is it's a group that is formed to engage in political activities. And many of these groups have been around for a long, long time. And again, under the regime that the Supreme Court laid out in Buckley v. Vallejo in 1976, So long as these groups did not expressly advocate the election or defeat of a candidate, they could pretty much do and say what they wanted. So they could call, you know, they could say such and such a candidate, you know, doesn't support term limits, and you should consider this when you go to vote. They could say, you know, he favors higher taxes, and you should consider this. As long as they didn't tell you to vote for him or against him, they were okay. They were a major target of the McCain-Feingold bill in this effort to limit the ability to run an ad even mentioning a candidate within 60 days of the election. So that's what they passed. But, of course, that didn't really make any difference because all these groups just started doing their activity more than 60 days before an election. I mean, all of us know a presidential campaign, heck, for 2008, it's already underway, really, you know. And so, you know, the campaign's a long time. So what has happened now is there's efforts now to put still further limits on citizen participation. So, you know, they want to limit even more your ability to get together, band together, and criticize office holders, talk about their voting records, talk about what they're doing in office. And it's, you know, it's going to be a growing spiral. The Bush administration, the Bush campaign people have chosen as a tactical matter to try to use the law to silence Democratic-leaning groups, and in doing so, of course, they've abandoned their former position in favor of deregulation.
And amazingly, groups like MoveOn.org pretend to be surprised, you know, that this law is being used against us. How did this happen?
That's right.
1-800-259-9231 or comments at DownsizedDC.org. We want to hear from you.
A congressman recently revealed that legislation totaling 2,900 pages and involving more than $1 trillion was available to members of Congress for less than 48 hours to study and consider. That's over 60 pages of legislation per hour. Do you think anyone read the entire bill? I'm Jim Babka with DownsizedDC.org. Consider a proposal buried in a 3,200-page, $388 billion bill, which would have empowered committee chairmen or their agents to examine Americans' tax returns. When this horrible provision came to light, no one claimed to know how it got into the bill. One congressman questioned said, "I didn't write it. I didn't approve it. I wasn't even consulted." If your attorney represented you this way, he might be disbarred. But this is how Congress represents you every day. That's why DownsizedDC.org has created the Read the Bills Act. You can force Congress to read their bills before they pass them at DownsizedDC.org.
You're listening to The Harry Brown Show on the Genesis Communications Radio Network.
Well, this is the short segment of the Harry Brown Show that wraps up the first hour. My guest has been Brad Smith, the author of Unfree Speech, The Folly of Campaign Finance Reform, and a former FEC commissioner. And folks, listen, we're dealing with some terminology here, and we're talking about something that, frankly, I've in trying to talk to people about this over the years, I found their eyes glaze, they get bored, they don't seem to get motivated about it, but I want you to pay close attention. We've laid some groundwork here, and we're going to lay out a couple more terms, because when we get into the next hour, when we start the show after the news break, we're going to start explaining how this applies, because this campaign finance issue, if you belong to the Constitution Party, the Green Party, the Libertarian Party, if you believe in independent candidacies, if you believe the challengers, you're concerned that they don't win the races, I want you to understand that a large portion of the reason that they don't win is the campaign finance laws. It's huge. Many people who are in the Libertarian Party who listen to Harry Brown, they're fans of Harry Brown, and you're listening to the show right now, may remember that Ed Crane of the Cato Institute used to be involved in the Libertarian Party. When Ed Crane walked away, he said the Libertarian Party can't succeed because of the campaign finance laws. That was in the early 80s. As Brad Smith just got through explaining to you, it's a lot worse today, and it's getting worse, and we're going to talk about some of that. We're also going to talk about the hope or the prospects for progress on this. But I want you to understand, if you want to know why incumbents continue to get reelected, you really don't need to look any further than this issue. So this issue is important. This issue does matter to you, and that's why we want you to call it 1-800-259-9231. Brad, let's get through a couple more pieces of terminology here. And this is a very short segment, so I'm going to ask you to keep the answers real tight here. Compelling state interest. This comes up in the Buckley case. The Supreme Court said that the state had a compelling interest in protecting its reputation. How does this work?
Well, this goes way back, a lot of Supreme Court doctrine. Basically, the court says certain rights are fundamental. One of those is freedom of speech. But state can still overcome them with a compelling interest. What's a compelling interest? It's whatever the court decides a compelling interest is. In Buckley, they decided that it was a compelling interest to prevent corruption or the appearance of corruption in politics.
And the only requirement is that they narrowly tailor the remedy as much as possible.
That's the idea. If the court finds that the state has a compelling interest, then it can regulate an area, but it has to narrowly tailor it. And by that, it means can't do any more than is necessary to address the problem.
And this was the first breach in, we're going to get to appearance of corruption in the next hour, but this was the first breach in political anonymity. Previously, just like going in and casting a secret ballot, you could make a contribution to a candidate, and it wasn't required by government law to be disclosed.
That's right.
And then there's the McIntyre decision, which comes in the late 80s, early 90s, that is another breach in this, or another support of this, I should say, of the anonymity principle.
Matt, right. The Supreme Court has long supported anonymity in speech, except it seems when you get to the area of campaign finance reform. So we have a system now where a person, for example, who a gay person gives $200 to the Log Cabin Republicans, that's a gay Republican group, they're essentially outing themselves, whether they want to or not. And in a host of other ways, you know, a young partner at a law firm makes a contribution to a political campaign, all the other partners know who he's supporting if they want to know.
Well, we're going to be wrapping up here this segment. We're going to come back. We'll talk about the appearance of corruption, and then we'll start to get into the meat of this so you can understand why this issue is so important to you. Right now, we're going to go to a news break, which means that you get a chance to stretch your legs, find out what's going on in the world, get something to drink, and then come back here at 6 minutes after, where we're talking to Brad Smith, former FEC commissioner.